Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. We're excited to have with us this week Angela O'Donnell from Fordham University. Teaches at the English department and is also the associate director at the Curran Center for American Catholic Studies. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Tim.
Well, Angela's here to talk about some of the poetry she's written in the pages of America and elsewhere, and also poetry in general. So we thought it'd be good to start off by perhaps having Angela read one of the poems that she's written, and one that actually appeared in America a few weeks ago, and this one is called St. Vincent. So would you mind doing the honors?
Absolutely, I'd love to. This is called St. Vincent. And the epigraph to this poem is, "The best way to know God is to love many things." Vincent van Gogh. What Vincent loved of sky, he told the crows. He taught them blue and the long note of want, the rut and whirl of time that comes and goes, God's face in the field, drawn and gaunt. What Vincent loved of earth, he told the trees. Their branches writhed like flames when they heard how every leaf and bole at last is seized and falls like olive stones and evening birds. What Vincent loved of salt, he told the sea. The play and savor of the friends of Christ, their sails taut, each mast a wood-crossed T, the empty boats afloat on waves of light. What Vincent loved of fire, he told the fire, then placed his wounded hand upon the pyre.
Well, thank you very much. Now, maybe we could start by just talking about how you got the idea for this poem.
Actually, the poem, when I first wrote it, was a little confusing to a person that I showed it to, because it... The assumption was that it was Saint Vincent de Paul, one of the conventional saints, the saints that are canonized, actually. And this is part of a larger project that I've been working on. It started actually with canonized saints, but gradually I began to realize that in terms of my own sense of who the saints are, who people who have lived exemplary and holy lives, it expanded to include naturally writers, since I love literature, artists of all sorts, various kinds of singers. So these are secular saints as well as people that we think of as being holy. And what happened with this particular poem is last summer, there was a wonderful exhibit at the New Gallery of Expressionism and Vincent van Gogh. And I went to this exhibit and there were a lot of paintings, probably 80 paintings or so of Vincent's that never have been outside of Amsterdam, or at least never brought together in this particular way. It was a very powerful experience, and this often happens with me with poetry. Some other art experience will provoke in me some response to it. And I went home just full of these images that made me realize just how close to heaven Vincent really was, despite the fact that, as we know, he lived a very tormented life. So I wanted to write a poem that just tried to encapsulate that paradox of his life. And it, actually, the first line just sort of came to me because I was thinking, of course, about that wonderful, famous picture of the crows in the field. And I realized quickly after that that this was going to be about Vincent's love of the world and the ways in which he transfers that to his paintings. So it's actually a structure in which that is iterated four times, what Vincent loved, what Vincent loved, what Vincent loved. And then I realized, oh my, it's a sonnet. So it sort of gradually came together in the course of probably, this one came pretty quickly. In the course of an afternoon, it found itself in sonnet form, and then I sort of hacked away at it for another month.
Okay, so you didn't sit down to write a sonnet, but it just sort of happened that way.
Yeah, it's funny how the poem sort of takes its own appropriate form as it develops, and sometimes I can predict, sometimes I can say, okay, I want to write a sonnet today, but there are times when I just realize I try to put it into a form and it's just not happening, and I just have to give it up and find something else for it.
And this poem is part, you said, of a larger project of poems about saints. Maybe you can tell us about that project.
Sure. As I mentioned, these are secular saints as well as canonized ones. And the ones that are canonized, it's interesting, those I tend to try to write in keeping with the liturgical year. So, for example, on the January the 28th, it was the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas, and I was reading Robert Elsberg's wonderful book about the
saints. Sure, I was thinking of that when you mentioned that.
Yes, it's such a wonderful kind of goad to the imagination, mm-hmm. because he's very good at telling you bits and pieces of the story that are really very evocative of that person's life. So I finished reading that and I thought, wow, you know, this is such a wonderful story. I wonder if there's a way to try to be more expressive and you know, sort of less straightforward in telling Thomas's story. And so that day I wrote St. Thomas. And actually that poem now, it has taken on different, I have a four-line stanza form of it, which I don't think is very good, and I have a three-line form stanza form of it, which I think actually is much better, but it's kind of still in progress.
So you began this project in the last year or so? Or?
Actually, it's been ongoing for about 2 years, and I keep sort of adding, I keep thinking, okay, I'm finished, I have enough, and then I have another saint that comes to me. And so the project is still morphing in my own imagination, and I'm having fun with it.
Yeah, well, you sent me a few poems before you came in today, and one here is called Saint Ahab. So obviously this is not a canonized saint, it's actually a fictional character. Maybe you could tell our listeners how you came up with the idea for that particular poem.
Sure. I'm an absolute Melville nut. I have taught Moby Dick over 40 times in the course of my teaching career, and so Ahab is one of those figures that I return to over and over again. He's such a flashpoint. He's such an attractive figure, even though he's a horrible villain. And that poem actually came after a poem that I wrote about Melville, which is St. Melville. And I wrote that poem after finding, after long search, Melville's grave in the Bronx. Which is just a couple of miles from where I teach.
Oh, I didn't know that.
At Fordham. Yeah, he's buried there. It's a wonderful stone. That there's an empty scroll on it. And this, of course, is kind of funny because, as we know, Melville couldn't stop writing. So the idea that he has an empty scroll on his stone is quite wonderful. It reminded me of the whiteness of the whale and all of those things. So I wrote the St. Melville first, and then after that I realized that Melville's greatest figure really needed in some way to enter into one of the niches in the sort of cathedral that I'm building of saints, even though he's an ironic saint, he's nonetheless needs to be there in some form.
Now, you had the St. Vincent poem published in America, and you've also had some poetry published in Christianity Today or Christian Century?
Christian Century.
Christian Century.
Yeah, a number of the saints' poems. St. Lazarus was in there a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Okay, and St. Lazarus, obviously somebody else who is not technically a saint, I guess, but another fascinating character. And you can see why you're drawn to some of these people. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how you got into writing poetry. I mean, have you been doing it most of your adult life?
Yeah, it's actually something that I started doing as soon as I could write when I was about 6 years old. And I think this is a very strange thing. I actually started writing poetry because I had older brothers and sisters, and I wanted desperately to learn how to read and write before I was in school. So my sisters had these books, which I'm sure kids don't really have anymore. They were called autograph books, in okay. which people would write little verses. So I actually taught myself to write by replicating the lines, in between the lines. Of course, I got in big trouble with my sisters after doing this. And I still remember one of the rhymes was, "When you get married and have twins, don't come to my house for safety pins." So I wrote that over and over again, you know, when I was 5 years old. And I think there's something about kind of the love of the play of language that, you know, instilled itself in me. And I, you know, then just started making up my own verses once I mastered writing and learned how to read. So
you've been doing it ever since
pretty
you were
much, yeah,
6 years old.
There mm-hmm. are periods of my life where I, you know, stopped. When I was an undergraduate, I was very busy. But the most important course I took was a wonderful poetry seminar with John Balaban, the poet John Balaban. And that helped to kind of shape my work. And then in graduate school, of course, I was very busy. When I had small children, I was very busy. And then it was actually reading a couple of other poets who were doing the sort of thing that I really wanted to do, but I didn't know it yet. Denise Levertov's book, The Stream and the Sapphire, was a great discovery for me because that sort of reminded me that that's really what I want to be doing.
Well, you mentioned your poem, St. Vincent, when you were at an exhibit of Vincent van Gogh's work and you got the idea and then went home and sat down and wrote about it. Is that how it usually happens for you? When the inspiration comes, do you have to sit right down and write?
That is probably half the time. Half the time, as soon as something comes to me, I actually carry a notebook with me everywhere I go. Mm-hmm. If I don't write down that first line, it won't happen. You know how it is. The rest of your day intervenes and you have a million thousand thoughts and you just lose it. So I make sure that whenever something comes to me, I mean, I hate to admit this, but even if I'm driving, I hold on to it until I stop at that stoplight and then I just jot it down so that I have it because it's a beginning of something. But I also must say that writing is a discipline. If you don't do it every day, if you wait for inspiration, then you're going to have precious few poems. So I rise early every morning. I usually get up around 5 o'clock, and I spend between 2 and 3 hours just either revising stuff that I've got in process, starting something new, or even just reading, you know, to kind of feed the imagination and feed the word hoard, as Seamus Heaney calls it, to try to kind of get something going. But so it's a labor of love, of course. I don't think of that as work. I think of it as a great pleasure. So
so you do find time in the course of every day to sit down and do this. Yeah.
I make time, because if I tried just to find it, I wouldn't.
It's funny, because I've often heard that advice from fiction writers or journalists, that you have to sit down a couple hours every day. But the stereotype among some of poets is that it doesn't require that kind of hard work. But as you say, it certainly does.
Yeah, well, actually, I admire fiction writers tremendously, because they do write a lot of pages.
Yeah.
And good fiction writers like Don DeLillo, let's say, I mean, they go over them and over them with a fine-tooth comb, and what they have at the end is just, you know, they're like little dense poems. And that, I think, is a much greater commitment of time than you would have to give to poetry. So, in fact, I have a lot of friends who are poets who admit that they became poets when they realized that they just couldn't put in the time to be fiction writers.
Well, also, I mean, it's somebody like Don DeLillo is able to make a living doing this. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a job, you teach, and you work at the Curran Center. So poets probably have a harder time, perhaps not as lucrative as
That's
perhaps.
For sure.
So this is, most poets are doing this, it's a part-time job by reasons of necessity.
Yeah. And well, the other beautiful thing I think about poetry, and one of the reasons I found it to be something I could do in all stages of my life, is it's the sort of thing, I mean, you can work a line in your head while you're doing something mechanical, you know. So when you have small children and you're taking care of them and you're preparing that 10,000th meal of peanut butter sandwiches or whatever, you can be thinking about the line, you know, and you could be working it. Whereas I think it's harder to do when you're trying to hold a whole novel in your head or something, because you're working on the small scale. So it's something that integrates itself into your life more easily, a busy life more easily, I think.
Now, you mentioned Denise Levertov. Maybe you can mention some of the other writers and poets who have influenced you in your career.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm very fortunate to get paid for doing the thing I love most in the world, which is talk about literature. And so, you know, people like Shakespeare, people like John Keats, people like Wordsworth, this is part of my daily bread. And these are people who, they're like an echo chamber in my head. You know, I have hundreds of lines from Frost, from Seamus Heaney, from all of these poets that are always sort of reverberating off of the walls and feeding my own lines. And quite honestly, I steal them sometimes. In fact, I think I have a poem in there in which the last two lines are of the poems that I sent to you. The last two lines are absolutely stolen from a Robert Frost poem, and my hope is that the reader will see that.
Yeah.
But as Eliot said, T.S. Eliot, good poets borrow, great poets steal.
Right. So who are some of the other poets that you look to as a writer?
Well, in terms of contemporary poetry.
Yeah, contemporary poetry.
One of my favorite contemporary poets is Scott Cairns. I don't know if you know his work.
He
has a beautiful book called Philokalia, and he has written a number of books. He's actually writing from the Greek Orthodox tradition, and he incorporates his faith into his writing. More and more, I've been interested in writers that are interested in the intersection between faith and the imagination. And Scott does that beautifully. Having said that, you would see precious little similarity between our writing, because we're very different kinds of writers. But I learn a lot from him. And I find his writing to be the kind of thing that touches off in me the need to kind of answer his own poems.
Now, would you say most of your poems have some faith component to them, or some spiritual component to them? Or is that something that you dip into now and then?
I think it's absolutely part of the bedrock, you know, landscape of my imagination, to mix a metaphor. There's a sense in which I don't think I can write anything that doesn't come out of that faith tradition. Even when, for example, I'm writing, you know, a poem that doesn't seem very religious, I'm sometimes surprised at the ways in which a religious impulse an impulse that's embedded in Catholic theology comes out. It's the only language I know.
Yeah.
So I speak it all the time. So even poems about family. I have a book of poems called Mine, and my full-length collection, Moving House, incorporates some of the saints' poems with some family poems. And it's interesting to me how sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between the saints' poems and the family poems. So I think it's just part of who I am and therefore part of how I write.
Now, how have you found it as somebody who writes religious poetry, Catholic poetry? Is it hard for you sometimes to get a hearing, perhaps in secular arenas, or you submit poetry to a secular publication, for example?
Definitely. Yeah. There's a real prejudice out there. The big magazines that, you know, every poet wants to get into are magazines like Poetry, like The New Yorker. And I find that there's a very strong prejudice, not only against my work, but against other people who are doing the same sort of thing. Every now and then, there is a sort of crossover poet. Mary Carr is a good instance of this. She has a wonderful book called Sinner's Welcome. She had a conversion experience about 10 years ago, and she is very conscious of her Catholicism in her work now. She writes poetry out of the Ignatian exercises that she did as a part of the conversion process that she went through. But because she was already an established poet, Poetry Magazine will publish her religious poems. Nonetheless, I am just delighted to see poems about the crucifixion in a secular journal like Poetry Magazine. So it's nice to see Mary Carr being able to make inroads into these traditionally very anti-religious, really, journals.
Good. Well, maybe that will help out other poets, other religious poets. We thought before we ended here, and this has been really interesting, you could read another one of your poems. This one also appeared in America. It's called Jesuits. When did you write this poem?
I wrote this poem in November of 2004. I was thinking about the awful experience of November 16th, 1989, when six Jesuits were killed along with their housekeeper and her daughter in El Salvador. I had just begun teaching at a Jesuit school. I had friends who were Jesuits. This event just was so horrifying to us. And every year, November 16th, we would honor it, we would think about it, we would pray for the souls of these people who had died. And I don't know why it is, but one particular year I just felt that the need to articulate this in a way other than prayer. And so I ended up writing this poem. It's called Jesuits, November 16th, 1989, El Salvador. One thing I probably should say at the outset is it brings together also conventional ideas about Jesuits that are drawn from various literary works, images that we have of them, and two of the literary works I refer to are James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, and Shisaku Endo's wonderful novel about the Jesuits in Japan, Silence. Jesuits. The pandy bat, the swift soutane, the fierce eyes that tempt the boy to pride. Ordinal in their ranks and rows, the God Squad, heaven's special forces. Trampling Christ's face before the smiling Inoue, in sacrifice of soul for tortured peasants. So brave, so fired by God's love, the Iroquois ate Brebeuf's martyred heart. A mighty story, terrible and true, beginning with Ignatius' shattered bones, Grace exploding from a French cannon, unfolding with the cold steel of dawn against the necks of five prostrate priests, the bodies of an old schoolmaster, a housekeeper, and her terrified child. Ignatius, imprisoned in the picture, the caves of Manresa behind his eyes, forever doomed to write his holy book, right hand brandishing the endless pen, his sword long left behind at Montserrat.
Well, Angela O'Donnell, thank you for reading that, and thank you for joining us today. We hope that you'll be able to come back again one of these days and continue to talk about these interesting issues.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
I want to thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. Wanted to report on the Oscar results and see how we did in our predictions last week. As you know, No Country for Old Men won the Best Picture award, and Father Jim Martin was correct in that prediction. Bill McGarvey and I both thought that Juno might eke out a win, but of course that did not happen, so kudos to Father Jim. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.